Introduction to Paralegal. This is the week 14 podcast covering the final chapter of the textbook, chapter 13, where we look at criminal law, criminal procedure. You will have the opportunity to take other courses that cover criminal law and procedure. Hopefully, one, you have to, and then others you can choose to. If you're kind of looking at that, a good summer elective is Administration of Justice, CRJ 227. Completely online anytime, and very interesting topics. That commercial over, let me give you one more commercial. If you haven't seen Peggy Crane, if you haven't made an appointment with Peggy Crane to get enrolled for the spring semester, please do so. Courses are filling. Not true in other things, but paralegal courses are filling. We already have, I think, the intro course is up to half capacity already after the first week. So get an appointment with Peggy so you make sure you get into your classes or desired classes. And the schedule was posted on the ICC Law site. It's also on the ICC website. So chapter 13. Criminal cases, as you are probably aware, are prosecuted by a public prosecutor. In Illinois, each county has a state's attorney. That state's attorney is the public prosecutor. That state's attorney is elected by the people every 4 years. At the federal level, there's a U.S. attorney for each of the districts. So, for instance, Illinois has three districts, northern, central, and southern, as we've covered, and there's a U.S. attorney and then several assistant U.S. attorneys for those areas. The U.S. attorney is appointed, and that's a federal appointment. Some defense attorneys work for organizations funded by the states. We have public defenders at the state level. There is a full-time public defender in Peoria County. Most public defenders, and some of you may intern or may work for in the future, someone who does public defender work, do that on a part-time basis, and they're provided with some benefit, but it's not their full-time line of work. The federal level, it's sort of the same. Most federal defenders or most lawyers who do defense work at the federal level are paid in the private sense, but there is also a public office or an office of the federal public defender, federal public defender. Some key differences between civil and criminal law. Crime is an offense against society as a whole. Criminal defendants are prosecuted by public officials on behalf of the state, and criminal law is statutory law. If you've not had criminal law yet, likely will, and you know that criminal laws are set out with elements of each crime by statute. The standard of proofs are different. We talked about civil law. For criminal law, the standard of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt. So if you go back to the example I used when we talked about standard of proof the first time in this semester, I asked you to hold your arms out, your hands, palms faced up, and your arms out to your sides, and pretend that that's a scale of justice. And on a civil case, that scale just needs to tip just a little bit. Beyond a reasonable doubt, that scale needs to tip all the way. All right, just think of it in that sense. Not necessarily exact, but it gives you a good idea. Criminal acts don't always involve a victim. Okay, we think of criminal acts as having a victim because we typically think of criminal acts as having, you know, the person who was murdered or assaulted, battered. Not always, though. The book has a nice little chart that gives you the areas of concern, the wrongful act, the parties who bring the suit, the standard of proof, and the remedy. That's also included in the slides. And if you look at that slide or in that chart in the book, it breaks it down for you. It tells you, you know, that who the victim is and who we are focused on and who's going to bring that action, and then standard of proof or what the end result would be, you know, damages in a civil suit, punishment in a crime typically. We think of crimes in three categories: felonies, misdemeanors, and petty offenses. When I teach Introduction to Criminal Law, we talk about the wedding cake approach. If you think about the typical wedding cake, and wedding cakes look way different sometimes, but the typical wedding cake, there's a large portion of the cake at the bottom, there's maybe a medium level, and then there's this little top level. Those of you who may be married or have been married in the past, it's sometimes tradition to keep the majority of that top level, and then you're supposed to eat it at a later date. Ends up in your freezer, and then you're supposed to pull it out and eat it. And in any event, the top level, you know, that's those, and when we think of crimes, that's those felonies, those things that we typically see on TV and typically gain notoriety and notice, but aren't the largest body of crimes. Misdemeanors fall in the middle there, and misdemeanors, there are a lot more misdemeanors. But the majority of time spent by police officers in going to calls is on that bottom layer of the cake, the petty offenses, the disturbing the peace kind of things. There isn't somebody that needs to go to the hospital or lost their life. There isn't some great amount of property damage. There isn't a serious concern, or as serious a concern. Felonies are serious crimes that may be punished by imprisonment for more than a year. And, you know, in Illinois, there's 4 degrees of felonies. Misdemeanors are crimes that may be punished by incarceration or jail not more than a year. And then petty offenses typically meet with fines. State statutes and federal statutes both define crimes. Federal criminal jurisdiction applies to things that occur outside jurisdiction of any state, involve interstate commerce or communications, interfere with operation of the federal government, or are directed at citizens or property located outside the United States. To be convicted of the crime, you must have performed a criminal act and had the specified state of mind or intent. We talked about civil law. You know, a lot of civil litigation cases that you hear about are negligence cases. There's no intent. You get in a car wreck and injure somebody because you were playing around with the radio or texting and driving or doing something that was negligent. You didn't do that intentionally, hopefully. You didn't run into somebody else's car intentionally, although people do that. If you did it intentionally, you're probably looking at a criminal charge. The criminal act, the actus reus, the guilty act, combined with mens rea, the wrongful mental state, and the wrongful mental state varies according to the action. Now, typically we think of crimes being committed by people, but corporations can face criminal liability. A corporation may be held liable for crimes committed against its or by its agents or employees. And then the law typically looks at its corporate officers. You may be familiar with a corporation located in Illinois, Archer Daniel Midland, ADM. There's actually a plant here in Peoria, Illinois. They used to tag themselves, I believe, I can't even remember what it is, grocery store to the world or something like that. They were, in fact, subject to a federal investigation and faced federal criminal liability. Now, just like anything else, when somebody alleges you did something, you are able to raise defenses. Some defenses to criminal liability: the person lacked the required mental state. Some others: protection of person or property. They were defending themselves or somebody else or property. There are statute of limitations as when you can be prosecuted for certain crimes. And just like anything else we've discussed thus far in this course, you always want to check the statute of limitations. Some others might be an alibi. They weren't there when the thing occurred, or mistaken identity. And if you're in my criminal procedure and evidence course, we just talked about identity and mistaken identity. Typically, we categorize crimes into crimes against persons or crimes against property. Homicide, assault, battery, robbery are crimes against persons. Burglary, larceny, theft, those are crimes against property or property crimes. When you take criminal law, you'll get to get into the elements. And taking robbery and burglary as two prime examples. A lot of times, somebody comes home and they find that their house had been broken into. Nobody was home at the time it was broken into. Some of their property had been taken. They call the police and they'll mistakenly tell the dispatcher, "I've been robbed." And a good dispatcher is going to ask some further questions, because if they put out to the police officer going to travel to that scene that somebody was robbed, robbery is a crime against the person. Robbery is physically taking property by force from someone. Much more serious than if somebody had broken into your garage or your house and stolen your stuff. Not that you're not going to be upset that they did that, but your personal safety isn't at issue, so the police aren't going to come lights and sirens, worried that you may be harmed or had been harmed. Okay, so again, that's just an example of those two, and then why we look to the elements. Some other property crimes: arson, forgery, receiving stolen goods. And then we also have public order crimes, crimes that are contrary to the public value or morals. You know, those are typically those crimes, actually you may have heard some of the political discourse that we have right now. The vice president-elect was the attorney general in California. I saw that she was being attacked because she was accused of wanting to legalize prostitution. What she had proposed or been part of was an effort to decriminalize prostitution for the prostitute, for the person who was alleged to have been a prostitute. Knowing, you know, a little background there, a lot of people who are working in prostitution aren't necessarily doing so out of choice. Many times forced into it at a young age. Many times part of that is an addiction to narcotics. And so decriminalizing, and you also see that with efforts to, like, drug court, where the focus is to try to get someone who is an addict, and maybe their crime is related to drugs, and if it's a nonviolent crime, they haven't harmed somebody, it's a property crime they committed to support their habit, they may be eligible for drug court. And the idea there is to decriminalize their activity, to get them help. And if they go and take the help that's available, if they get, you know, rehab, counseling, education, job training, and they turn things around, and whatever it was that was helping to cause their habit, they move past, then we don't tag them as a criminal. Because what happens when we tag somebody as a felon or misdemeanor convicted person? They have more difficulty finding work. They have more difficulty finding a place to live. They have more difficulty finding traction and getting towards a normal life. And so those, you'll see more of that. Public order crimes facing decriminalization. So it's not necessarily a crime for those things that may be contrary to public value or morals. And that's different, of course, than the pimp who tries to force somebody into prostitution, or the person who is selling the heroin to the addict. Different situation. Okay, just to kind of give you that PSA there, because I know it's been out there in the news this week. There are also white-collar crimes. White-collar crimes are financial crimes, embezzlement, mail or wire fraud, bribery, bankruptcy fraud, theft of trade secrets, insider trading, those kind of things. The various phone calls that you get, the people try to get your information, you know. We all unfortunately have to face those all too regularly. We also have organized crime, money laundering, RICO Act, Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organization Act. People get together to do things that are corrupt, financially based, to make money. And RICO has been tied to a lot of different things. Cyber crimes. You know, these aren't new things anymore. Cyber theft, financial crimes, identity theft, stalking, cyber stalking, hacking. The book talks about social media and criminal justice. Criminals are using social media to seek out victims and organize their criminal activity. They use it as a way to communicate. And law enforcement agencies are expanding their use of social media in solving crimes. If you take my evidence class, we talk about smartphones, combing social media sites, you know, going in and finding what people are posting or finding people through things that are posted. Now, if you're an investigator, a police officer, or you're a paralegal, you're going to use these resources a lot. A lot. And you probably already do this anyway. You want to find out about somebody, you need to just pop them into Google, or you look on their social media if they haven't opened to everybody, and you check them out. I know you do it. Constitutional safeguards. And you'll hear more about these things in other courses, but Fourth and Fifth Amendments, the Fourth Amendment prohibits unreasonable search and seizure. It requires a showing of probable cause. The Fifth Amendment provides due process of law, prohibits double jeopardy. It provides a privilege against compulsory self-incrimination. The Sixth Amendment provides you with the expectation of a speedy and public trial. A trial by jury. A right to confront witnesses. A right to a lawyer at various stages, as soon as it becomes adversarial. The Eighth Amendment prohibits excessive bail. It prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. The exclusionary rule is something you'll spend, and if you're in my evidence class now, you've spent a great deal of time on. All evidence obtained in violation of your rights is excluded. Anything that came from anything excluded, that we call that the fruit of the poisonous tree, is excluded. The exclusionary rule deters warrantless searches and other misconduct. It can lead to injustices. So a defendant who is in fact guilty of whatever it is can get off on a technicality through the exclusionary rule. So when I teach this, I always stress, especially those people that are going into law enforcement, know the law. Know the procedures of your department. Do things by the book. Do things by procedure. Do things properly. And those of you going into the paralegal field, you're going to look to see if they did. And then Miranda. Miranda versus Arizona is a 1966 case. I was born in 1964. That means that Miranda is 54 years old. But it's still good law. And Miranda said that arrested individuals must be informed of their rights, those rights that I just told you about. You aren't entitled to your Miranda rights until you are in custody. In custody doesn't mean that you're handcuffed and put in the back of a police car. In custody means you don't believe you're free to leave. Okay? You don't believe you're free to leave. And the major rights at that point are you have the right to remain silent and you have the right to a lawyer. So you'd always be advised to be quiet. Insist on a lawyer. If you believe you're unable to leave or they tell you, the police tell you you're unable to leave, you, at that point you're in custody. Now, most law enforcement officers are going to have, and I always suggest my students have, they're issued, when they first start out, a card, department-issued card that lists the rights. You have a right to remain silent. Any statements made may be used against you in a court of law. You have a right to talk to a lawyer and have a lawyer present while being questioned. If you can't afford a lawyer will be provided for you. And then the suspect has to be asked if he or she understands these rights and whether they want to exercise those rights or waive those rights, not exercise those rights, and talk to the police. All that's laid out on that card, and I would suggest that the people who go into law enforcement pull that card out of their pocket and read it. And now you're on, you know, cameras everywhere. Your dash cam, your body cam, somebody else's body cam, somebody standing on the street corner. There's cameras everywhere. You can record it. So when somebody comes back and says, I wasn't read my rights, or if they weren't read their rights, it's recorded, right? Some other criminal procedure things to note. Arrest and booking. Detention is not arrest. Probable cause. We have to have probable cause that a crime was committed and that the individual who was being detained committed the crime. There are two types of warrants that we're always concerned with in criminal procedure. An arrest warrant, a warrant to take someone into custody, and a search warrant, a warrant that allows the police to search a particular place, area, thing. Now, when you take the CRJ 230 course, we'll get into all the details of those warrants and when they're needed and when they're not needed. Now, just like when we talked about the civil investigation and the things that a lot of you will do as paralegals, the police do after an arrest. They find and interview witnesses, they conduct searches, or they find evidence, physical evidence if there is any. But they do some things differently. They may show witnesses the suspect in various ways, in lineups, photo arrays. After further investigation, they may decide that they're not going to arrest the individual. They may release the suspect with a warning or refer that individual to a social service agency. They may seek some other remedy. But the prosecutor has discretion as to whether or not somebody will be prosecuted. The police don't decide that. The police go to the situation, they do their investigation, they may decide to arrest, but the prosecutor decides if that arrest is going to be furthered into prosecution. Prosecutors have broad discretion. They decide whether to pursue a case. Typically, just like in civil law, they allege as many offenses as possible. Sometimes we refer to that as throwing all the mud at the wall. So as many things as the person may have done that the elements may support, that the facts may indicate the elements of crimes for, the prosecutor may bring those charges. Typically, there's a range. There may be felonies and misdemeanors, and the defendant may plead guilty to one of those things or more in exchange for having others dropped. The book goes all through the whole prosecution process. The prosecutor can decide to take the case to the grand jury and have the grand jury indict the individual, or they can file a complaint. At this point, the defendant is taken before the judge. If bail is applicable or under consideration, there's a discussion about bail and the judge decides bail. There's a preliminary hearing where the judge determines whether evidence is sufficient to establish probable cause. It's the first adversarial proceeding. If you're a paralegal, you're probably going to be involved in assisting either for the prosecutor or defense, depending on who you're working for. And then eventually we get to the trial. Now, as we discussed with civil cases, only a small fraction of criminal cases go to trial. Most defendants plead guilty to the offense or a lesser offense prior to trial. Both sides have an incentive to negotiate a plea because they've gone through discovery. Both sides know what the other side has. And so you have a much better idea at that point what the odds are for either gaining a conviction or being convicted. The book tells you that most criminal trials last less than a week. There are some procedural differences between criminal and civil trials. The presumption of innocence, the prosecutor bears the burden of proving the defendant guilty. The defendant does not have to take the witness stand. In a civil trial, if I represent the plaintiff, I can make you as the defendant take the witness stand. I can call you to the witness stand. In a criminal trial, the defendant can't be compelled to testify. The standard of proof is higher, as we said. It has to be, or there's a right to a speedy trial. So in a civil case, it may take 2 years to get an average negligence case to the trial court in Peoria County at this time. Typically, a criminal case is going to go a lot quicker than that. It's going to make it to trial a lot quicker because there's a right to a speedy trial. The jury verdict must be unanimous. And if it's not unanimous, it's a hung jury. The jury is typically not involved in sentencing unless it's a death penalty case, and we don't have that here in Illinois anymore. The judge will sentence the individual after getting a pre-sentence investigation report from the probation department. And our criminal statutes set forth a maximum and minimum penalty for each violation. So the judge has this range. And the individual can either be incarcerated, go to jail or prison, or have probation with a combination of penalties that can include fines, expectations that they do certain things, that they not get in any more trouble, that they check in with their probation officer, etc. Now, I mentioned diversion. Diversion is, and we have a, you know, in this country, we've realized a few things. The war on drugs that started with the Nixon administration wasn't exactly productive when we were talking about users. And a lot of people went to jail and prison for things that they can now do legally in a lot of jurisdictions. So we have drug courts. We also have some other diversion courts that are starting to crop up across the country. But the idea is to avoid the criminal prosecution if the person does some things and uses some resources to change there, to divert their path. So that's criminal law and procedure. It's the last chapter we're going to discuss. If you didn't read the book, please go read the book. You bought the book, read the book. Before you jump into trying to do the assignment for this week. Now, this is the final week of the textbook. It's not the final week of the class. We are going to have class this week, and then we're off for a week for Thanksgiving. Don't forget to come back. What we're going to do in the 15th and 16th week is not difficult, but you have to do it. So put the energy into this week. Put the time and effort into the assignment this week. Finish this week. Put in your calendar. You're off Thanksgiving week. But then week 15 starts the following week after Thanksgiving. So come back. The assignment will be posted Thanksgiving week. If you're bored, you can get working on it. But the same expectations, right? You do the things that I need you to do for weeks 15 and 16. And, you know, it's not going to be that difficult. But if you don't do it, you're below 100 points. No sense in that. This is week 14 podcast. Positivity rates are up. I got a, in the short time that I've been doing work this morning, I've had students contacting me that they believe that they're positive. One is positive. They're heading to get tested. And then one of my sons called to say he's going to get tested. He was exposed. So it's happening. Wear your mask. Take care of yourself. Get sleep. Eat well. And finish out this semester, this and all courses, with the effort that they deserve. Because you deserve that effort. It's not about the grade. It's whether you're prepared to do the job.